KSDP 830 AM Sandpoint, K201DA King Cove, KFPS False Pass.
Good morning. The president wants to remake the federal government by restricting how it spends money and reducing the workforce. Does that infringe on Congress's power of the purse? We'll ask a Republican lawmaker on Morning Edition from NPR News. Compared with others, Robert F. Kennedy Jr. had to wait for his confirmation hearing. I'm Steve Inskeep.
And I'm Michelle Martin. Today he faces public questions from senators amid opposition on both the left and the right. Plus, we hear from the Anglican bishop of the city in the Democratic Republic of Congo that rebels have taken over, and from a fierce defender of Israel who's become one of its most outspoken critics. It is Wednesday, January 29th. Happy birthday to Oprah Winfrey. The talk show host, producer, actor, and media mogul is 71 years old today. The news is next.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Kristen Wright. The future of the Trump administration's suspension of federal spending for grants and other financial assistance programs is uncertain. A federal judge paused the freeze. NPR's Deidre Walsh reports Republican lawmakers holding a retreat at one of Trump's Florida resorts are largely backing the order.
House Speaker Mike Johnson argued that the president's action was appropriate for a new administration and would be quick and harmless.
I think this is something that the American people will approve of. I think they want us to be good stewards of the precious treasure of the American taxpayer.
But Nebraska Republican Don Bacon said the administration would have been wise to notify Congress. He said his constituents worried about the impact on programs relying on federal aid. While GOP lawmakers did acknowledge confusion about the details of which programs were covered and said they needed clarification, most did not publicly criticize the Trump administration's order. A federal judge has temporarily blocked the spending pause until Monday, February 3rd. Deirdre Walsh, NPR News, Doral, Florida.
Robert F. Kennedy Jr. is slated to begin his confirmation process before a Senate committee today. NPR's Will Stone says he'll face tough questioning about his qualifications to serve as health secretary.
Kennedy is an environmental lawyer descended from a political dynasty who spent years leading a prominent anti-vaccine advocacy group. He's emerged as one of the most recognizable and controversial figures in the Trump administration's proposed cabinet. Many in the medical field warn his views are dangerous for public health. He's pushed false ideas about a link between vaccines and autism and made other inaccurate claims about their safety and infectious diseases more broadly. His supporters have embraced his pledge to disrupt the medical establishment and reverse the chronic disease epidemic. As secretary, Kennedy would wield enormous influence, overseeing agencies that steer biomedical research, pharmaceuticals, health policy, and insurance coverage for more than 100 million Americans. Will Stone, NPR News.
The nation's report card has been released. It's an important snapshot of how fourth and eighth graders are doing, nearly 5 years after pandemic school closings. NPR's Corey Turner says it's not the report card many hope to see.
A lot of not so good news, because even in fourth grade math, kids still aren't back to the scores we saw before the pandemic. In fact, when you break the data down, in only one state, Alabama, are fourth graders doing better in math than fourth graders were doing before the pandemic. One state. And in eighth grade, there's a really worrying achievement gap that's been widening between top and lower performers.
Fourth graders did do better in math than in 2022, educators hope ending a pandemic slide. This is NPR News. New recommendations from a coalition of health and nutrition organizations say kids and teens should mostly stick to water and plain milk and avoid drinks with added sugar. NPR's Maria Godoy has more.
The recommendations come amid a proliferation of new drinks marketed to teens, including energy drinks and blended coffees. Here's Megan Lott of Healthy Eating Research, a program of the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, which led the coalition behind the new guidelines.
New research has shown us that even small amounts of caffeine can cause delayed sleep onset, increased amounts of depressive moods and anxiety and other mental health issues that are really problematic for young teens.
The guidelines also call for kids and teens to limit their intake of plant-based milks because the panel concluded they don't offer the same nutrition as cow's milk. Maria Godoy, NPR News.
East African leaders are holding an emergency meeting to discuss the worsening security situation in the Democratic Republic of Congo. Hundreds of people have been killed and thousands displaced following days of heavy clashes between rebels and the Congolese army. Rwandan-backed M23 rebels have taken over Goma, the largest city. The U.S. Embassy is advising Americans to leave after protesters attacked embassies in the capital, Kinshasa. It is the Lunar New Year. To celebrate the Spring Festival, millions of people across Asia and other parts of the world are ushering in the Year of the Snake, a time for renewal and new beginnings. I'm Kristen Wright, and this is NPR.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include Amazon Business, committed to being a digital purchasing solution for businesses so that growing the business is the main focus and not admin and paperwork. Learn about smart business buying at AmazonBusiness.com.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Steve Inskeep.
And I'm Michelle Martin. Good morning. A federal judge has temporarily blocked President Trump's plan to freeze federal assistance and grants while the administration conducts an ideological review of government initiatives after state and federal officials reported widespread confusion, even chaos, when House Press Secretary Caroline Leavitt used her first news briefing yesterday to say that direct payments like Social Security, Medicare, and food stamps are not affected.
This administration, if you are receiving individual assistance from the federal government, you will still continue to receive that. However, it is the responsibility of this president and this administration to be good stewards of taxpayer dollars.
But even with that caveat, Democratic lawmakers are saying this far exceeds the president's authority under the Constitution, since the Constitution gives Congress the power to decide how much money the government spends and where it goes. We're going to ask a Republican lawmaker for his thoughts. Representative Pete Stauber of Minnesota is with us now. Good morning, Congressman.
Good morning, Michelle. How are you?
I'm good. Thanks for joining us. Look, I think you're at a Republican lawmakers retreat or strategy session, but I assume you're still in touch with your office. Are you hearing from constituents who worry that they're affected by these changes?
You know, we got some calls, but the fact of the matter is this is just a temporary pause in discretionary spending. As the president said on the campaign trail, Michelle, that we have to rein in our spending. We have a $36 trillion debt, and I myself have six children. The youngest are 3 and 4. We have to do better. We cannot continue to spend and spend and spend. Our economy will collapse, and so I support the president's effort on looking at discretionary spending, whether it, we make the determination, does that discretionary spending, Michelle, make America safer? Does it make us more strong or stronger? And does it make us more prosperous? So those are the questions we ask on this discretionary spending. And we have consistently said Michelle, that the pause is not affecting individuals' benefits,
okay.
Your SNAP benefits, your welfare benefits, your Pell grants that are coming to you. That is not going to be affected, and that's misinformation by my colleagues on the other side of the aisle.
Okay, well, one reason we called you is that you sit on the Transportation Committee. The president's been very critical of the climate-related initiatives that were in the infrastructure bill passed in 2022, which does represent a huge investment in roads, bridges, you know, and the like, the biggest in a generation. Now, I know you voted against it, but even people who voted against it are seeing those projects in their district. What happens to them?
So the hard infrastructure projects, like the roads and bridges, the hard infrastructure projects, Michelle, are going to continue to go through. They're going to look at them quickly and say, this is hard infrastructure. These roads and bridges are necessary for a safe traveling public. But what they are going to look at, for example, there was a $7.4 billion, that's with a B, billion dollars put aside for electric charging stations. And the federal government has installed 11 of them in the last 3 years. That's not a good return on our investment. So we're going to look at that discretionary spending and all the bills that have passed. And I think that's what the American people want.
But I would think
that's what the American people voted for.
Forgive me. I would think that would be an operational issue, not a budget issue. But that really leads to my next question. Is the Constitution gives Congress the power of the purse. Why should the president be allowed to basically ignore decisions that Congress and congresspersons like yourself have made?
Well, I think that obviously going through the process right now, again, it's a temporary pause. Look, for example, the $50 million that the U.S. government was about to send into Gaza for condoms. The $30 million, Michelle, that was going to be spent on other items that we've found in just the first 26 hours.
Okay, I can't speak for the truth or falsity of that claim. I apologize, Congressman, but I have no independent knowledge of that. But having said that, the question does this not undermine the authority that has been invested in you as a representative of your constituents?
I really don't believe it does. I think the president has every right to at least look at the spending that's happening. If it's egregious, it's got to stop. If it doesn't make America, Michelle, safer, stronger, and more prosperous, we have to look at our spending. Look at what's happened with inflation. It's crushing the American people.
All right. That is Republican Representative Pete Stauber. He represents a district in Minnesota. Congressman, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you very much. Have a great day.
Today, Robert F. Kennedy Jr. takes questions from senators about his bid to lead the Department of Health and Human Services.
It is a consequential job. It oversees all of America's health agencies, including Medicare, the Food and Drug Administration, the National Institutes of Health, and more. It has an annual budget of $1.7 trillion, which is about the size of Australia's GDP.
And Kennedy has offered a lot of opinions on health over the years. NPR's Selena Simmons-Duffin is here. Good morning.
Morning, Steve.
Okay, so what has Kennedy said and done that lawmakers may have questions about?
Well, first of all, he spent decades as an anti-vaccine activist leading a group called Children's Health Defense, and he believes a thoroughly debunked claim that vaccines cause autism. I am sure we'll hear a lot about that since this job has broad powers over federal vaccine policy. He has made millions of dollars over the years suing vaccine makers, and he could profit off of lawsuits against Merck while in this job that regulates drug makers. He also denies that HIV causes AIDS. That is an established scientific fact. And he frequently compared COVID-19 public health measures to Hitler's Germany. In this role, he would be in charge of the response if there's another pandemic crisis. So there is just so much to talk about. It's really hard to predict how the hearing will play out, but it will definitely be interesting.
What is the case that his supporters are making for RFK Jr. in this role?
They portray him as a change maker who will direct scientific research towards the root causes of chronic diseases. He's talked a lot about the importance of healthy food and getting additives out of the food supply. I reached a White House spokesperson last week who told me Kennedy has met with more than 60 senators and he's prepared and excited for this process.
And I guess we should note here and there, there's been a Democrat who said, listen, I agree with Kennedy about this one thing and there. But then there are efforts to block his confirmation because of all those other opinions you just mentioned. What's going on?
Yeah, so this is definitely a strange bedfellow situation. You have Protect Our Care, which is a left-leaning advocacy organization running ads targeting Republican senators, saying he's an anti-vaccine extremist. They point to an incident in Samoa, which is a Pacific island that Kennedy visited in 2019, just before a measles outbreak that killed 83 people. Thousands of doctors have been speaking out, saying infectious diseases like measles, also polio, meningitis, could make a comeback if the federal government stop supporting routine vaccinations. And then you have Kennedy detractors on the right as well.
Oh, that's interesting, because so many people on the right have felt they need to support everything the president does. Who's resisting?
Well, former Vice President Mike Pence objects to the fact that Kennedy has been supportive of abortion rights. Now Kennedy says he'll go along with Trump's opposition to abortion rights, but Pence does not buy that. And his group, Advancing American Freedom, has been running its own ads against Kennedy. Also this week, two conservative media outlets, the New York Post and the Wall Street Journal, ran editorials against his confirmation.
I'm beginning to wonder, Selena, if just one confirmation hearing is going to be sufficient for all the questions that senators have.
Well, actually, he has two. So today is the hearing in the Senate Finance Committee, and tomorrow is the hearing in the HELP Committee. The Finance Committee will actually vote on his nomination, and after that, it will be voted on by the full Senate.
Okay, HELP Committee, Health, Education, Labor, what's the P? Do we know the P?
Pensions.
Oh, pensions. NPR Selena Simmons-Zeffen, thanks so much.
Okay, thank you.
Ahead of the Super Bowl in New Orleans, state authorities have used an emergency declaration to relocate people living on the streets near the Superdome. Governor Jeff Landry called their encampments a security concern. Here's Stephen Basaha of the Gulf States Newsroom.
Before they were broken up, these encampments were expansive.
It must have been probably about 200-400 people before these people started taking them away.
Corey Johnson lives near one of the former encampments. It used to be under a highway, just a short walk from the Superdome.
It had tents all around the church, all down the street from the church, across the street, all around the corner. Now you can't even find a tent.
What's left includes abandoned clothes, a walker, and a deflated air mattress, all under signs that read, no encampment. The governor's office set up a transitional center about 6 miles away for people to stay at instead. It's a modified warehouse with about 200 beds, hot meals, and heating. It's planned to be open for 2 months and paid for with millions in state dollars. Going there is supposed to be voluntary, but Angela Ozarek with the homeless advocacy group No Harm says some people were told they'd be arrested if they didn't.
And they were separated from their belongings. People's belongings were brought separately from them, and many people have not yet been able to access their belongings again.
Louisiana is far from the only place to sweep away homeless encampments before Super Bowl and to get criticized for it. There was Los Angeles in 2022, Atlanta in 2019. A couple blocks from the New Orleans Superdome, Jeremy Davis was asking people for a few bucks. He says no law enforcement told or asked him to leave. He's also not sure if he'd agree to go to the center.
I guess it depends on what comes after those 3 months. The 3 months gives you something to think about, you get what I'm saying?
He wants to know what will happen when the center closes. Mike Steele is a spokesperson for the governor's office, and he says social workers at the center are working to find permanent housing for people.
That's why it's a transition center and not necessarily a shelter. So they want to find solutions for this group and help them take that step.
Local homeless advocates criticize the forced encampment closures, but added that given the recent bitter cold weather and snow, the relocations likely saved lives. For NPR News, I'm Stephen Misaha in New Orleans.
This is NPR News.
On the next Fresh Air, our anti-social century. We talk with Atlantic staff writer Derek Thompson about how loneliness is shaping our politics, personalities, and sense of reality. Join us.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from Progressive Insurance. Progressive is looking for individuals in a variety of career fields who want to help build a culture of inclusiveness. More information, including application, at progressive.com/careers. From the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, supporting creative people and effective institutions committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world. More information is at macfound.org. From Indeed, designed to be an end-to-end hiring solution for businesses of all sizes to attract, interview, and hire candidates, all from one platform. Learn more at Indeed.com/NPR. And from ECMC Foundation at ECMCFoundation.org.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Steve Inskeep.
I'm Michelle Martin.
And I'm Layla Faldin. Over his lifetime, Peter Beinart went from being a fierce defender of Israel to one of its fiercest critics. In his latest book, the professor of journalism and political science makes an appeal to other American Jews in the wake of the war in Gaza. It's called Being Jewish After the Destruction of Gaza, A Reckoning. The book begins with a note to his former friend.
I know you believe that my public opposition to this war and to the very idea of a state that favors Jews over Palestinians constitutes a betrayal of our people. When I enter a synagogue, I am no longer sure who will extend their hand and who will look away. Maybe you feel a similar anxiety in progressive circles where you once felt at home. Jews have always quarreled, and we should, but I worry that given the trajectory of events in Israel and Palestine, we may be moving past mere disagreement toward hatred.
Why did you open the book this way?
Because the book really came out of my struggles over the last year and a half, in some ways longer, with a community that I love, that is at the center of my life, and where I have many of my closest friendships, but from which I feel sometimes profoundly at odds, because people who I respect and love seem to me to be able to look away from the horrors of what Israel is doing to Palestinians and justify those. And so I wanted to write to those people.
Now, you've been a very public critic of Israeli policies, Israel's occupation, for many years. Can you talk about the way your views changed?
Sure. I grew up in many ways not differently than many, many American Jews, in a family in which Israel's existence gave us a sense of comfort and security. But it was only late in my life, in my 30s, that I spent time with Palestinians in the West Bank. And one of the things that always has stuck with me was when I was talking with a Palestinian mother, and she told me that when she had a boy, her daughters started to cry. And they were crying because in their town, boys throw stones sometimes at Israeli soldiers. And the Israeli military comes in the middle of the night to people's homes. They don't really necessarily know who threw the stones, but they'll take the teenage boys screaming out of their homes, hold them often in solitary confinement for a day or two or even more. And I just thought, what is it like to live with this kind of fear? And I have been raised to think so much about our fear and our trauma as Jews, and I really hadn't thought about the kind of trauma and fear that Palestinians experience.
Now, you address this in your book, but there are going to be people that listen to what you said who bristle at this and say, what about the violence that Jewish people in Israel have suffered? Suicide bombings, the October 7th attack on Israel.
I want to make it clear that when I talk about the conditions that exist of oppression for Palestinians, it does not justify attacking civilians and taking civilian life. But to me, if one wants to keep Israeli Jews safe, one has to think about the underlying conditions in which the terrible violence that happened on October 7th occurred. If you're going to keep it from happening again, most of the Palestinians under Israeli control, those in the West Bank and Gaza and East Jerusalem, live as permanent stateless non-citizens under a state for whose government they cannot vote. In the West Bank, under military law, even though their Jewish neighbors live under civil law. The United Nations said Gaza was unlivable before this war. Yes, Hamas was authoritarian and often incompetent, but when you block people off from the rest of the world in a space roughly the size of an American city, you're imposing tremendous, tremendous violence on them.
You also write about, right after October 7th and the attack on Israel, scouring anti-war essays and speeches for outrage over the murder of innocent people, hundreds of Israeli civilians, and you don't find them. Was that hard? I mean, that's also a community that you belong to and are a part of, and including it in the book. What was that message?
Yes, I think that sometimes there is a way in which in mainstream Jewish discourse, Palestinians are often dehumanized. But there is also a way sometimes in leftist discourse or anti-Israel, anti-Zionist discourse in which Israeli Jews are dehumanized. And people say, well, they're just settlers, so they have what's coming to them. I think if this movement for Palestinian freedom is to be a great movement for justice, it cannot use that language. One can be outraged by the system of oppression that Israel maintains over Palestinians and still recognize that the lives of Israeli Jews are deeply, deeply precious, and that the horrifying act that was committed against them on October 7th was the wrong way for Palestinians to resist their oppression.
This book is an appeal, right?
Yes.
What is the appeal?
The appeal is to recognize something which I think is basic in Judaism, which is that human beings are created in the image of God, and human beings, all human beings, have infinite dignity. States are mere instruments for the protection of human life. And what has happened in mainstream Jewish discourse is that the value of this Jewish state has been elevated above the value of the lives of the people under its control.
Hmm. There's a lot of people that will hear that will not like that. They'll say, you know, we need this state and we need this place to be safe, and it needs to be for Jewish people.
Yes, but I really believe that there can be a flourishing, vibrant Jewish, Hebrew-speaking society in Israel-Palestine without a state that gives Jews rights that Palestinians don't have. And you know what's the most dangerous place for Jews in the world today? It's Israel, because its political system imposes tremendous violence on Palestinians, and that makes everyone less safe.
That was Peter Beinart, a professor and the editor-at-large of Jewish Currents, on his new book, Being Jewish After the Destruction of Gaza, A Reckoning. This is NPR News.
Christy Dashiell is nominated for her first Grammy Award for a jazz album that shows off her vocal range and emotional depth.
The human themes of love, loss, grief, joy, friendship, all of us can relate to that, black, white, brown, whatever.
I'm Elsa Chang. More on her new album, Journey in Black, on All Things Considered from NPR News.
Wondering where...
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Dave Mattingly. President Trump's pick to lead the Department of Health and Human Services appears before a Senate committee this morning Robert F. Kennedy Jr. is expected to face questions about vaccines and abortion rights amid widespread opposition to his nomination from the medical community. The president's nomination of Pam Bondi to serve as Attorney General is expected to clear the Senate Judiciary Committee today. Bondi is the former Attorney General of Florida. Some employees of the federal government are being offered what the Trump administration calls deferred resignations if they agree to leave their jobs by the end of September. Here's NPR's Andrea Hsu.
The offer came in an email with the subject line, Fork in the Road. It started by summing up the major changes that the Trump administration is bringing to the federal workforce, including an end to telework and a downsizing of agencies. Then it laid out a choice for federal workers. Those who want to resign can offer their resignation before February 6th, be put on administrative leave, and keep their full pay and benefits through the end of September. Those who want to stay were told, quote, we cannot give you full assurance regarding the certainty of your position. The email was sent to most of the civilian workforce. Some exceptions include post office employees and people doing immigration enforcement and national security. Andrea Hsu, NPR News, Washington.
This is NPR News from Washington. The founder and CEO of Boom Supersonic is describing the company's first supersonic flight over California's Mojave Desert yesterday as phenomenal. With a pilot at the controls, the XB-1 demonstrator jet reached a speed of 750 miles per hour at an altitude of 35,000 feet. The company hopes to build supersonic jets to carry commercial passengers. More than two decades after Air France and British Airways stopped flying the supersonic Concorde. French President Emmanuel Macron says the world's most popular art museum will undergo an extensive renovation, as NPR's Eleanor Beardsley reports from Paris.
Standing in front of the Mona Lisa, Macron announced that a new grand entrance to the Louvre would be built and new underground galleries excavated. Leonardo da Vinci's iconic painting, which is constantly thronged by visitors, will have its own exhibition space. The colossal six-year project known as La Nouvelle Renaissance will cost upwards of $800 million and be entirely paid for out of the Louvre's substantial budget. An international architectural competition will be held for the design of the new entrance and wings. Macron said promoting art and cultural understanding is an important political battle in an era when forceful rhetoric holds hypnotic power over so many. Eleanor Beardsley, NPR News, Paris.
I'm Dave Mattingly in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from Arm, committed to delivering innovative, advanced computing designed to enable worldwide companies to unleash the capabilities and experiences of AI. The future of AI is built on Arm. Arm.com. And from the Kauffman Foundation, providing access to opportunities that help people achieve financial stability, upward mobility, and economic prosperity, regardless of race, gender, or geography. Kauffman.org. This is NPR.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Michelle Martin.
And I'm Steve Inskeep. Good morning. The United Nations Security Council has been talking about the Democratic Republic of Congo. Rebels in that country claim to have taken control of the city of Goma, which happens to be in a mineral-rich region. So how far could this war spread? We begin our coverage with NPR's Michelle Kellerman.
Eastern Congo is home to some of the world's largest reserves of rare earth minerals. It was at the center of what was once called Africa's World War a couple of decades ago. And these days, a Rwandan-backed rebel group known as the M23 has overrun the city of Goma. A UN official, Vivian van de Perre, made an impassioned plea from there during a Security Council meeting.
The degree of suffering that the population in Goma and its environments is truly unimaginable. Let us please draw on our humanity and do our utmost to bring an immediate end to such levels of violence and suffering.
Speaking via video, wearing a flak jacket and helmet, she said 178,000 people have been uprooted in the recent fighting, and the humanitarian situation is dire. Three UN peacekeepers have been killed. While Rwanda and the DRC traded accusations in the Security Council, the UN Secretary General spoke to the leaders of both, according to spokesman Stéphane Dujarric.
The crisis in eastern Congo has been going on for decades. It's not going to be solved in 24 hours. What is clear is that it will not be solved through military operations by different governments, by different militias.
Tensions are also spilling over in the Congolese capital, Kinshasa. Protesters set fires outside the UN offices and the U.S. Embassy, as well as many other diplomatic posts. The U.S. Embassy is closed to the public, and the State Department is advising Americans to shelter in place and leave the DRC when and if they can. At the UN, U.S. Ambassador Dorothy Shea said the world must not allow the violence to spiral into a wider regional war.
Rwanda must withdraw troops from the DRC. Rwanda and the DRC must return to the negotiating table and work toward a sustainable, peaceful solution.
And if they don't, she says, they should face a, quote, clear and unambiguous response from the Security Council. Michelle Kellerman, NPR News, the State Department.
For more on this, we want to turn to someone who knows the area well. Martin Gordon is the Anglican Bishop of Goma. That's the city in the Democratic Republic of Congo that rebels have taken over. He fled with his family on Saturday, the day after Goma lost power. Today, he's issuing a call for peace, and he's with us now. Good morning, Bishop. Thank you for joining us.
Good morning. Good to be with you.
Can you just share with us your experience of leaving Goma? What was the city like when you left?
We left on Saturday lunchtime. It was eerily quiet. Some of our friends and others had been leaving from Thursday. But the city of Sake to the west of Goma, which was a red line for many NGOs, that had fallen. And our government had already suggested that all its citizens left. So we had some time. We had some time to pack. We drove over the border in relative calm. And as we crossed the border, we saw many of our friends and colleagues, particularly those with children, also seeking to leave. I mean, ironically, the main challenge we had leaving that day was to get our car papers in order. But we know that we're some of the few with the possibility and the means to escape. Most of the clergy and all of the believers, the Anglican believers, and all of our other colleagues are still in Goma. And they're the ones who've been suffering. Goma has had no power since Friday. Internet's been patchy. There's little water in some of the city. Hospitals are overflowing. And with the battle that then took to the streets of Goma, many civilians were caught in the crossfire. There's eyewitness accounts of bodies in the streets, and food prices have doubled. So there seems to be chaos on the ground, and fighting is still in pockets of the town.
Now, you've lived in Goma for about 5 years. Has this conflict touched members of the diocese before?
It has. It's something that conflict in eastern Congo is something that we have lived with for 30 years. But between 2012 and 2021, there was relative calm. And then the M23 took up arms again in 2021. And so our diocese covers much, much more than Goma. In the north in Rutshuru and in the west in Masisi, we've had schools that have been destroyed by bombs. We've had many of our clergy at one point in the last 2 or 3 years have had to flee for their lives and hide in the forests. We've had roadblocks. We've had increasing food prices. It's essentially paralyzing activities in North Kivu. But until really this month, Goma was largely spared. And so the conflict is not new, but what is new and what has caught the world's attention and what may put an end to the conflict now is the fact that the city of Goma seems to be largely in the hands of the Rwandan-backed M23 rebels.
Now, we've been hearing about destruction taking place at foreign embassies in Kinshasa, which is the capital. People are angry at international powers for not intervening. And I understand that you are a clergyman, you're not a diplomat, but from where you sit and from what you see, what would be helpful here for the international community to do, to respond to this?
So you're right. I mean, the anger and the frustration that just burst into life in Kinshasa, and you know, we're not in any way condoning what happened to the embassies, is the measure of frustration that this is new. We've been saying this, the Congolese people have been saying this for years, and there have been many fine-sounding statements from the UN, from the European community. What we need now is action. So what the UN Security Council have said, what the US Secretary of State has said in a phone call both to President Tshisekedi of DRC and Kagame of Rwanda is absolutely right. The M23 must withdraw, Rwanda must draw its own troops, but we need an immediate ceasefire, a cessation of hostilities, humanitarian access. But the international community now needs to step up and go beyond fine-sounding statements and to put the necessary pressure, particularly on the Rwandan government, to withdraw, to allow aid access. And the only solution, as everyone is saying, is a negotiated solution. So the international community needs to do everything it can to get people around the table and to use its economic and its diplomatic muscle and its financial muscle to enable peace in the region, because this could spill into a regional conflict, and all the Congolese people really want is peace and a chance to go about their daily lives.
That's Martin Gordon. He's the Anglican Bishop of Goma. He escaped from Goma with his family on Saturday. Bishop Gordon, thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you.
This is NPR News.
A new podcast follows the story of music mogul Sean Diddy Combs and how his dominance in the music industry papered over allegations of sexual violence. Next time on Here and Now.
The latest in national politics, inspiring podcasts, and a report from your local school board meeting last week. You can hear it all in one place with the NPR app. Download it today.
Good morning.
morning. I'm Michelle Martin. The next supersonic passenger jet might be coming soon. A private company's test flight just busted the sound barrier yesterday over California's Mojave Desert. Boom Supersonic plans to build a passenger jet designed to cruise at Mach 1.7. That's roughly twice as fast as current commercial airliners and well above the Mach 1 sound barrier. The company says United, American, and Japan Airlines have all expressed interest. It's Morning Edition.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from the George Gund Foundation, working to make Cleveland more vibrant, sustainable, and just, and setting an example for the nation. More information available at gundfoundation.org. From the Doris Duke Foundation, which aims to support the well-being of people and the planet for a more creative, equitable, and sustainable future. And from the William T. Grant Foundation, supporting research to improve the lives of young people, at WTGrantFDN.org.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Michelle Martin.
And I'm Steve Inskeep. Good morning. Some residents of Georgia say they're having health problems after a fire in a chemical plant. The fire last fall released a toxic plume of chemicals near Atlanta, and we still don't know everything that was in it. Here's Pamela Kirkland with Georgia Public Broadcasting.
Cheryl Garcia doesn't like the way she sounds these days.
Because this is not my voice. This is my biolab voice.
She calls it her biolab voice, blaming chemical exposure from the fire for irritating her throat and triggering her asthma. Garcia is a retired nurse practitioner. She and her husband live just a few miles from the biolab plant where chemicals for swimming pools and spas are produced. She said her primary care doctor was clear about the cause of her symptoms.
He put it on my medical record that it was due to chemical exposure.
She hadn't thought about her asthma in over a decade until the September fire.
Rockdale County 911, how can I help you?
We got a freaking head bus and biolab.
The fire sent a massive plume of toxic smoke into the air, prompting 17,000 residents to evacuate and emergency responses from multiple agencies. 90,000 others, including Garcia, were told to shelter in place for 2 weeks, mostly at night. Reports of a chlorine odor stretched throughout metro Atlanta. Researchers like Greg Huey at Georgia Tech say early tests found other chemicals in addition to chlorine in the plume. They found irritants like bromine and isocyanic acid that can cause symptoms like coughing and wheezing. His team is analyzing more air quality data and expects to share the findings in the coming weeks.
This might help people know what they're exposed to in this incident, but more importantly, if ever something like this happens again, we might have better ideas what to look for.
But it's not the first time there's been a fire at this biolab. There have been five over the past 20 years. After the most recent fire, Biolab opened a community assistance center to handle claims and reimbursements for those affected by the fire. It's now closed. Cheryl Garcia and dozens of others signed on to a class action lawsuit against Biolab and its parent company, Kick Consumer Products. Community frustration with the company is growing. Around 100 people attended a town hall last month to share their worries about lingering health problems.
I am so scared. I am so scared. I don't know what to do.
Sandra Stevens-Jordan told the crowd her house is just 4 miles away from Biolab. She had to shelter in place.
I live in pain. I have pain every single day. And then with the biolab thing happening, it has made my health even worse.
Georgia Senators John Ossoff and Raphael Warnock recently sent a letter to Kick Consumer Products asking that they release debris test results, share reimbursement amounts, and extend the deadline for people to make claims. In an email, the company says they're reviewing the letter and that Biolab will continue to work with the community. It also wants to work, quote, constructively with authorities, regulators, and elected officials. Meanwhile, Cheryl Garcia says she wants more oversight of chemical companies.
This is not just a Conyers problem. This is not just a Georgia problem. This is a national problem. Excuse me.
She's interrupted by a cough. A reminder, she says, of the Biolab fire. For NPR News, I'm Pamela Kirkland in Conyers, Georgia.
This is NPR News. It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Steve Inskeep.
And I'm Michelle Martin. Good morning. I want to let you know that this next story includes descriptions of sexual assault. It's a story about accusations of sexual abuse by one of France's most revered religious and humanitarian figures. Abbé Pierre was a Catholic priest who made his name fighting for the homeless. He died almost 2 decades ago. But now the church has called for a full judicial investigation into accusations of rape and sexual assault against him. NPR's Eleanor Beardsley has this report from Paris.
In the brutal winter of 1954, with homeless people freezing to death, French priest Abbé Pierre shook the nation's conscience with a radio appeal.
Toi qui souffre, qui que tu sois.
Those who suffer, whoever you are, he declared, come sleep, eat, and take hope. You are loved. Born in 1912, Henri Grouès joined the French resistance as a young priest. He became known by his nom de guerre, Abbé Pierre. After the war, he founded a charity network in France. The diminutive priest with his signature beret became a major voice for those on the margins of society.
Everybody in France loved Abbé Pierre, not only the Christians, everybody loved him. Think of a French Mother Teresa.
That's Xavier Lenormand, editor-in-chief of La Croix, a respected Catholic daily newspaper. In 2007, thousands spilled out of Notre Dame Cathedral for Abbé Pierre's funeral, applauding as his coffin passed. But not until last July did the revelations of abuse begin to emerge. So far, 33 people, mostly women, say Abbé Pierre sexually assaulted them. 4 were minors at the time. 1, then a boy, says he was raped.
Comment l'abbé Pierre a-t-il
a recent documentary on French television network BFM, Abbé Pierre, 50 Years of Impunity, shows how the priest often preyed on the vulnerable who sought his help. Pascal, whose last name is not revealed, reached out to him in 1993 when she was alone and trying to get help for her severely scarred face from a fire in her childhood.
Tu es folle de joie.
I was mad with joy when he answered my letter, she remembers. I thought, finally, I'm saved. Abbé Pierre brought Pascal to live for 2 weeks in one of his homes for the poor. The abuse began in his office. She was 18, he was 80.
Il m'a attrapé.
He grabbed and groped me and pinned me to the wall, she says. Other victims describe similar violence, but to speak out would have been like denouncing God, says one. This month, the head of the Conference of Bishops in France, Éric de Moulin-Beaufort, asked the Paris prosecutor to open a full investigation, even though there is no one alive to prosecute.
Je considère qu'il faut aller jusqu'au bout de la vérité qui doit
être faite. We have to get to the bottom of this and find the whole truth. Not only the victims, but anyone who might have known, to understand why no one came forward.
While the French public was unaware, some who worked with Abbé Pierre did know about his predatory behavior.
Quand l'abbé Pierre entreprend son voyage aux
États-Unis, the documentary shows the diary entries of the theology professor who helped organize Abbé Pierre's trip to the U.S. and Canada in the 1950s. His visit had to be cut short to avoid a scandal after several women complained. But no disciplinary actions were taken. Inside one of the shops run by the Abbé Pierre Foundation in Paris, 53-year-old Anne Massé is browsing through racks of secondhand clothes.
It's difficult to talk about this, very difficult, because a long time I love him, I love this man. Il a fait pendant des années des belles choses.
Switching to French, she tells me he was a light, a hope, an example, and he's destroyed everything. The French face a dilemma, says newspaper editor Lenormand.
The accusations against him are awful, and what it is awful, but the reason why he was a hero are still valid. So it's a national trauma.
This week, Abbé Pierre's charity foundation voted to remove his name. In a statement, the board said he will always be part of our history, but it has become impossible to honor his memory. Eleanor Beardsley, NPR News, Paris.
The new White House press secretary took part in a long-standing White House ritual yesterday.
Good afternoon, everybody. It's an honor to be here with all of you.
Caroline Leavitt conducted her first briefing as White House press secretary. She is 27, the youngest person to hold the job.
While I vow to provide the truth from this podium, we ask that all of you in this room hold yourselves to that same standard. And we will call you out when we feel that your reporting is wrong or there is misinformation about this White House.
Now, Caroline Leavitt worked her way up from White House intern to assistant press secretary in President Trump's first term and was a familiar voice during the 2024 presidential campaign. Here she is on Fox News.
The Democrat Party has become the party of elitists who look down on the everyday working man and woman in this country.
During his previous term, President Trump had four press secretaries. Sean Spicer lost a lot of credibility at the start when he picked up his boss's line about the crowd at his inauguration.
This was the largest audience to ever witness an inauguration, period.
Another press secretary, Sarah Huckabee Sanders, handled the briefings more smoothly. She went on to become governor of Arkansas.
Then there was Stephanie Grisham, who didn't give formal briefings at all. She became a Trump critic after the attack on the Capitol in 2021. Caroline Leavitt's inaugural briefing had a few tense moments.
So you're asking a hypothetical based on programs that you can't even identify.
No, I just identified.
What I can tell you...
And ended with a promise from Leavitt to reporters that they will be seeing a lot more of her.
Caroline Leavitt, the White House's newest and youngest press secretary.
Now, reporters are putting questions to the administration today about another story that emerged overnight.
The Pentagon is moving to remove the security detail for retired Joint Chiefs Chairman General Mark Milley, who is under threat from Iran. The military is also revoking Milley's security clearance, and the defense secretary is directing the Pentagon's inspector general to conduct an inquiry into General Milley's conduct that could lead to a reduction in rank.
That is one of the first actions under Trump's newly confirmed Secretary of Defense, Pete Hegseth. General Milley repeatedly criticized Trump and also worked behind the scenes to ensure a peaceful transfer of power after the 2020 election, or as peaceful as possible. Former President Biden issued a preemptive pardon of Milley before leaving office.
We will stay on top of this story and others as they develop. Stay connected by listening live on the NPR app or your local station. It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Michelle Martin.
And I'm Steve Inskeep.
Thank you.
about you, a thought goes through my mind. What a marvelous time.